Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It is an ancient cultural tradition. It's cruel. It's beautiful. It's an unfair fight. It takes incredible skill, and yes, the bulls die every time. The matadors, sometimes. Tonight we talk with a journalist who's been deep inside the world of the matador, literally the killer of bulls. Tonight on Point, the art, the spectacle, the tragedy of bullfighting. But first, it was a nail-biter to the end, but very early this morning, just after midnight, the House narrowly approved the Central American Free Trade Agreement. The 217 to 215 squeaker will remove most trade barriers between the United States and Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and the Dominican Republic. The trade pact was approved by the Senate last month, 54 to 45. Most of its provisions take effect immediately. Some will be phased in over 20 years. For a look at what CAFTA will mean in the short and long term for the American economy, we turn to Paul Magnuson, Washington correspondent for Businessweek magazine. Paul, thanks for being with us tonight.
Happy to be here, Tom.
So tell us where you're looking for first impact. Where are we first going to see these countries and Americans acting on the barriers that have been brought down?
Well, I think what the Central American countries expect is increased U.S. investment as the first effect. It was best summed up by what the Nicaraguan trade minister told me, which was that you're going to be losing these jobs anyway. They can either go here or they can go to China. Which do you prefer?
So when you say investment, you don't just mean, in bonds or something. You mean in manufacturing facilities in these
countries. That's right, and plant and equipment in Central America, primarily at this point probably clothing manufacturing.
So textiles or clothing in all of these countries, or are there a few that are the most likely early targets?
Well, Nicaragua has the lowest wage rates, and so that will be one factor. But most of the countries, Guatemala and Honduras in particular, and El Salvador as well, have already established clothing manufacturing. So,
what about the kind of manufacturing we've seen go across the border into Mexico? Heavier manufacturing, is that likely in Central America as well, or it's too far, not the right labor base?
I don't think that won't be the first that you see. But yes, eventually there will be some more heavy manufacturing.
So, is the presumption then that yes, indeed, this is really a new target for American jobs? As you say, the Nicaraguans saying they'll go to China or they'll come here. For Americans, is that the number one consequence of this, jobs going to Latin America?
I don't know that it's the number one consequence. There are many consequences. The U.S. intellectual property sector of the U.S. economy was particularly interested in this. The pharmaceutical manufacturers want to sell down there. They want to export, but they want to make sure that their patents are not pirated, and that generic drugs aren't going to be bought up by the government rather than their own. So that's another factor. That's not necessarily investment down there, but it's certainly exports. So there are a lot of factors involved, but I think the most immediate one will be the movement of more apparel-producing capacity down to Central America.
U.S. agriculture also pleased with this development?
Very pleased with it. They are expecting to export quite a bit to Central America. Then the critics of the CAFTA, on the other hand, insist that what this will do is to displace subsistence farmers in Central America, and therefore, as happened with Mexico and NAFTA, put more pressure on immigration to the north.
I'm sure there are different ways of looking at this then. If we look forward, Paul, what kind of evolution over time are people seeing in the relationship between the U.S. and Central America as a result of this opening up?
Well, the Central American countries have become democracies over the last decade, and they have strengthened their economies. Some of them are doing better than others, of course, but they're all generally doing better. And it's hoped that this will encourage more economic reform and more opening of their economy, more jobs, higher incomes, and so on.
Labor in America upset with this. Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, saying it's a step backward for workers in Central America and a job killer here at home. Are there any guarantees in here about labor regulations in these Central American countries where jobs may be going?
There are some labor provisions in CAFTA. The critics of CAFTA say that they're too weak to really matter. For example, there's an agreement by the signers that they will enforce their own labor and environmental standards. And if they don't, there's a mechanism whereby fines would be levied on the countries for not doing so. However, they pay the fines to themselves. In other words, they fine themselves, or they are fined, and then the money goes to, say, the Department of Labor or an environment in one of the countries, and they're supposed to spend it on that.
And, Paul, finally, what about the flow of Americans south? We already read about a lot of retirees looking south for lower-cost retirement homes. Will this change the environment for investment at the level of real estate? Are we likely to see a kind of southward migration of retiring Americans as a result of this?
That's a very interesting question. There are investment guarantees, and there are provisions that would tend to, I don't know about encourage, Americans to buy land down there, but they would certainly make the purchase more secure.
Paul, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Paul Magnuson, Washington correspondent for Business Week magazine. He spoke with me from Washington. About a decade ago, Edward Lewine was an American tourist in Spain. Like so many tourists, he went to a bullfight. And like a rider or two before him, he got pulled in. After years of attending bullfights in Spain whenever he could, he got permission to spend an entire season traveling with Francisco Rivera Ordóñez, a famous young bullfighter with a huge family legacy to live up to. His great-grandfather, grandfather, and father were all celebrated bullfighters. Lewine follows Fran, as he's called, through triumphs, failures, a serious injury, and recovery to perform again, and through his paces in the ring with the bulls who die as his own father died, bullfighting. Tonight on Point, the art, the spectacle, the tragedy of bullfighting. You can join the conversation. Is there mystery and grace in the bull ring for you, or just death? And did Hemingway bring you to see romance in the bullfight, or tragedy, or both? What keeps a spectacle like this going in the 21st century? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is author Edward Lewine, author of Death and the Sun, which follows a season with one of Spain's top bullfighters. Edward Lewine, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
So here we are, bullfighting all these years after Hemingway, and somehow it keeps reaching out. It has some little grip on everybody's imagination, whether they're drawn to it or repulsed by it, and it got its claws into you. Why? What was it? What took you back to the ring?
You know, I went to my first bullfight. Actually, reluctantly, someone invited me, a Spanish friend. I was in Madrid, and I really didn't want to go. And I went, and I loved it. And that horrified me and thrilled me at the same time, and it sort of made me want to go back and find out what about this, you know, this thing which had many horrifying aspects was also so wonderful. And I think in the end, 15 years later, that's exactly what I'm left with. It is both horrible and beautiful, wonderful and terrible at the same time, and therefore gripping.
We're going to learn a lot about bullfighting tonight, but before you take us into what you learned, try and take us back to what it was before you were really versed in what's going on in the ring. What's the nature of that appeal? Not as a Spaniard yet. You write a lot about how the Spanish see bullfighting, understand it, about the history of it. But for you, as kind of coming in naively, as you say, you didn't even want to go and you ended up gripped. What is it? What does that? Why?
Well, in my case, perhaps this wouldn't be so for everyone, but in my case, part of it was that, you know, so much of our world is homogenized now. And sitting there in the Madrid Bullring, a wonderful bowl which has no advertising, no electronic scoreboard, the King of Spain was sitting in the royal box, the costumes of the matadors. And I thought to myself, this could be 300 years ago. And I was immediately struck by the magnificent sense of place that one has with bullfighting. You can't go to a bullfight in Russia. You cannot go to one in Boston. You cannot go to one in most parts of the world. And you are present in a different culture in a way that I thought was magnificent. So that was the first thing. And the second thing was I was compelled by this allegory of death. I lost my father. My father died when I was a 10-year-old boy. And I've always been interested in death. It's always been a thing which has been of interest to me. And Hemingway argued, and perhaps I'll argue too, that it ought to be of interest to all of us.
Of course, the subject of your book, the matador you followed, also lost his father when he was 10 years old. Francisco Rivera Ordóñez, the son and grandson and great-grandson of matadors all. You learn a lot more about him, and so will we tonight. But is death part of the fascination for him, for the matador?
No. I wouldn't go that far. I think it's always difficult to psychoanalyze people, especially people who come from different cultures. So I try to stick with what I really know about him. But what I know about him, what he would say, I think, if he were here, is no. In fact, quite the reverse. I think his entire career, in a way, is an attempt to prove that what happened to his father, who was gored and died shortly thereafter in outside of a bullring in 1984, what happened to his father was not the fate that we're all that he was fated to. Fran is out there to prove that he's going to live.
That he won't die as his father died. Edward Lewine, author of the new book, Death and the Sun, A Matador's Season in the Heart of Spain. Stand by. We're talking tonight about the art, the spectacle, the tragedy of bullfighting. You can join us. What keeps a spectacle like this alive in the 21st century? And what's the elemental drama being played out in the ring? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the art, the spectacle, the tragedy of bullfighting. My guest tonight is Edward Lewine, joins us from New York City. He's author of the new book, Death and the Sun, A Matador's Season in the Heart of Spain. He spent most of a full season, with season runs from February to October, with a young matador in a line of matadors, perhaps the most celebrated, famous line of matadors in Spanish history. His great-grandfather was the model for Hemingway's matador in Sun Also Rises. His grandfather model for another Hemingway book. His father died famously from injuries in the ring. The first death of a Spanish matador to be seen on television again and again and again around Spain. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you been? Have you seen? What did you think? Do you respond to the Spanish claim that this is art? Do you see it? And is there magic, mystery in the bullring to you, or just death? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Edward Lewine, the story of this young man and his family is a gripping one, but I'm not sure we really understand it until we review exactly what goes on in that ring. And I wish you'd take us there and walk us through the ritual of the bullfight. It is highly ritualized, as you remind us. Give us a quick tour of the history and what happens in an ordinary bullfight in Spain.
Well, it's a very complicated ritual, but to put it simply, three matadors and their teams of five assistant bullfighters, each matador has a team of five, will kill six bulls, the bulls normally being bred from the same ranch. The matadors kill the bulls in order of seniority. Each bull spends approximately 20 minutes in the ring, and it is put through a highly stylized sort of series of acts or parts. To begin with, the matador comes out and passes the bull with a large cape. Then a horseman comes out, and the bull is made to charge the horse, and the horseman spears the bull, usually two times. Then the matador's assistants come out and place barbed sticks in the bull's hide, three pairs normally. These are called banderillas. And finally, the point of the event, which is the matador comes out alone with a small red cape hanging from a stick and a sword and attempts to construct a performance, a dance, if you will, with the bull, using the cape to direct the bull's charge, creating hopefully a beautiful and also scary, thrilling dance with the bull. At the end of this, which usually lasts about 5 to 10 minutes, the matador will line up in front of the bull, run directly at it, use the cape to push the bull's head down, and put a sword between the bull's shoulder blades, which, if it's done correctly, will kill the bull not by piercing its heart, but by severing the aorta or some other major blood vessel.
So much to grab onto there, and some will be swept away at the grandeur. Others will just be appalled at the killing, and you talk about that. We'll come to you. You write about that. But I want to understand each of these three movements, if you will, of the bullfight a little better. When you say they come out and spear the bull, they're putting these barbed sticks in, where do they go? Exactly what's happening there?
Well, the point, everything that's done in a bull ring is not done to taunt the bull or it's not done gratuitously. It's to prepare the bull, literally the way an artist might prepare a canvas for the final act that I described, the dance with the cape. The picador, that's a word many people are familiar with, will put the spear right into the area right behind the bull's neck in order to lower the carriage of its head. The banderillas are sort of harpoons, if you will, with A-shaped barbs at the end, and they kind of just they go into the bull's hide and they just catch right underneath the thick hide and then hang down from the bull. Each of these things is meant to focus the bull, lower the carriage of its head, and get it into the kind of shape it needs to be in, both mentally and physically, for the matador to create with it at the end.
What's the size of these bulls? What's their temperament?
Well, they're unlike anything. If you've never seen one, you've never seen anything like it. They weigh approximately 1,200 pounds. They can hit speeds of about 30 to 35 miles an hour in short bursts. And they are as powerful and ferocious a creature as you'll ever encounter. A flick of one's head can send a grown man 15 feet into the air, and often does. And they're bred to be ferocious. They're bred to charge. And they have a kind of the great bulls have a kind of a serenity and courage about them that's magnificent.
Now, you write about how not all Spaniards are enthralled anymore. Barcelona has passed some kind of local law barring bullfighting, if I've got that right.
Well, the Barcelona Town Hall passed a resolution saying they were against bullfighting, but it didn't carry the weight of law. In fact, there was a bullfight that very Sunday in Barcelona. But there are many parts of Spain, which don't have much of a bullfighting tradition. The Northwest, Galicia, which is the part of Spain where most American Spanish people come from, they don't really care for bullfighting that much. But bullfighting is very strong in Madrid, in the south, and in the Basque region, in the northeast, and in Valencia along the Mediterranean coast. The rest of the country is less enthused with it.
And as you tell us repeatedly in the book, the Spanish see artistry in bullfighting. In what you describe as the dance of the bullfighter and the bull, there are these three qualities that are sought after: parar, mandar, and templar. I wish you could describe for us what those are, how they're expressed in a bullfight.
A matador, to properly work with a bull, must do these three things. Stand still. Sounds easy. Very difficult when a bull is charging at you. That's parar. Mandar means you stand still and you use the cape to make the bull go where you want mandar to command, rather than getting out of the bull's way, which is the bull making you go where he wants you to go. And then finally, templar. This is much harder to discuss, but it's essentially grace. And what it means is that you take this wild animal and you use this cape to make the wild animal go where you want it to go, but you don't just do it in a herky-jerky fashion. You do it so smoothly, so suavely, and often so slowly that you seem to even be controlling the elements of time and space. And when it happens, and by the way, it rarely does, but when someone really manages to work with a bull using parar, mandar, and templar, it's an amazing sight.
And describe for us just logistically, physically, what's going on in the ring when Spanish audiences who are into this are sort of made ecstatic by the bullfighter's performance. What's he achieving? What's really just physically happening?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, and the answer is complicated because it depends on where you are. If you were down in Seville, they'd be shouting "Olé," and there'd be a kind of what they call alegría in the ring, you know, kind of the beautiful spirit, everyone very happy. If they were in Madrid, it's quite likely where they take things very seriously, and quite likely there'd be a lot of people protesting and shouting even when the person is doing well, because they sort of like to think of themselves as people who are so exacting that they almost never are happy with the performance. If you're up north in Pamplona during the running of the Bulls Festival, everyone will be so drunk and cheering that there'll be many people who won't even notice what's going on in the ring. So it really depends on where you are.
All that is great to learn, but I guess what I really wanted to ask was what exactly is going on between the matador and the bull when the crowds are enthralled? Describe the dance to us.
Well, the way I like to put it is that what a matador does with a cape by himself in front of the mirror, and that's the way matadors practice, is beautiful to watch. These are fantastically graceful men, and they're doing what looks like a wonderful kind of folk dance using the cape. If you imagine the way a wonderful dancer might kind of, you know, passing it in front of their bodies, almost the way sort of, you know, like a kabuki dancer with a fan. But when you take that rather beautiful but relatively sort of minor folk dance and you add the terror and the beauty and the menace of the bull and the fact that the matador is doing this in a way and in doing this risking his life and limb, you have something which is both beautiful and sort of thrilling at the same time. And that combination of beauty and thrill is really what Spanish audiences are looking for.
And physically, the matador is getting the bull to follow the cape wherever he wants it. He's coming as close as possible to the bull without being harmed. He's turning the bull into a kind of a what? He's winding the bull around himself, as I read you describing it.
In a way, yes. And I mean, one of the things that's sort of paradoxical about bullfighting is that, as a number of people have observed, when it's done properly, to the outsider, it may not look like much. What you see is a guy standing still and running a cape, holding a cape in one hand and sliding it across his body, and an animal following it, often at a very slow trot. But if you understand what it takes to do that, it's an extraordinarily impressive thing, because he's actually literally controlling the pace of this wild animal's charge and playing it in the same way that a musician might play an organ, harnessing the power of the wind to make music. The matador is harnessing the power of the animal to create a dance.
Now, I want you to read a bit for us about what goes on there. But before you do, we need a little more introduction of the matador called Fran, very well known in Spain, celebrated Francisco Rivera Ordóñez. Describe this young man for us and his lineage in bullfighting.
Well, you described it very well. His great-grandfather was the model for Hemingway's Matador and The Sun Also Rises. His grandfather is thought by many people to be the greatest matador of the last 50 years of the 20th century, and was also in a book called The Dangerous Summer that Hemingway wrote. And his father, also named Francisco Rivera, was killed by a bull in 1984 outside of Pozo Blanco, which is a small town up in the mountains above Cordoba. And that event was in many ways the most convulsive media event in modern Spanish history. And so everyone knows where they were when Fran's father died.
Convulsive because he was filmed essentially on his deathbed on the surgery table just outside the ring, sort of instructing the doctor how to attempt to save his life. And this, as you write, revived bullfighting after it had fallen into kind of disfavor.
Great matadors had died before. No one had seen a great matador die, although, in fact, the footage does not show him dying. And, in fact, he died about an hour after the footage was shot. But, yes, his dignity, and he lay there on the table and he said, "Doctor, the horn went in here and it went here. Open me up. I put my life in your hands." And then he's telling all the people in the room, "Tranquilo, tranquilo, quiet, everybody quiet." And just his attitude and his bravery really raised the status of bullfighters from a point where it had been tumbling a bit in Spanish society.
His son was 10 years old when his father died, and as you describe it, he said to his mother, "I will be a bullfighter." You followed him for months during this bullfighting season. I wish you'd read us a bit from one bullfight that you describe here on page 43, if you could. Edward Levine's Death and the Sun is the book.
A ring attendant opened the heavy door to the bullpens, and Fran's first animal came out, shiny black, rippled with muscle, built along the lines of a small pickup truck. The bull was terrifying and freakish. It belonged in the forests of an earlier age or in someone's bad dream, not in the middle of a city at the beginning of the 21st century. The bull stopped for a moment, raised its head, looked around, and sniffed the air. The great pot roast of muscle on its neck rose and twitched with fear. Without warning, the bull galloped stiff-legged across the sand, a rope of drool spilling from its black mouth. As it approached the wooden barrier, it lowered its head and chopped hard with its right horn, flicking the horn up and taking out a hefty chunk of wood, leaving a white scar in the red paint. Then the bull sauntered back to the center of the ring and waited to be challenged. Fran slipped through a small opening in the wooden fence that surrounded the ring. He spread his purple and yellow cape out with both hands, letting it fall in front of him like the skirts of an elegant ball gown. Then he raised the cape, shook it, and shouted. The bull wheeled and headed straight for Fran. Fran's hat pushed down over his eyes, he flared his nostrils and scrunched his lips into his face, grimacing with the effort of staying still. The bull came. Fran didn't move. The bull lowered its head, arching its neck forward. The left horn, a white curve with a black tip, sliced at Fran's left leg. But just before the horn reached flesh, Fran dropped his right hand, spreading out the cape, and the bull followed the motion of the cloth a few inches to the right, just enough for the horn to whiff by Fran's leg as he moved the cape, turning it first with his shoulder, then his waist, then his arms, capturing the bull in the gentle slipstream of the cloth, slowing the bull and moving it across his body and on out to the other side. Olé.
Olé comes the cry from the stadium, from the arena. Edward Lewine reading from his new book, Death and the Sun, A Matador's Season in the Heart of Spain. Edward Lewine, a lot of callers want to join us, but before we turn to them, I want to bring another voice into this conversation, someone who has not been enchanted by bullfighting. William Rivas joins us from Washington tonight. He's a spokesperson for PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and he created the Running of the Nudes protest in Pamplona to call attention to the cruelty of bullfighting. Mr. Rivas, thank you for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
So here's Edward Lewine in a relatively interesting line of writers who have gone to Spain, seen bullfighting, and been drawn into its mystery. How do you look at it?
Well, I mean, I look at it from having had that very same experience, going to Spain as a tourist, going to a bullfight, and expecting to see something very much like your guest described, something very beautiful, something very traditional, something that has been in the culture of Spain for hundreds of years. But what I saw was a farce. What I saw was the torturing and killing of a defenseless animal. No matter how you describe it, no matter what historical implications it has, the fact that we are torturing and killing a defenseless animal and celebrating it simply because it's tradition, I find abhorrent. I find something that I could not support. And the moment that the first bull was killed, I was in shock. And that was long before I had worked for PETA or became an animal rights activist, but really put in motion my ideas of bullfighting.
And what is the running of the nudes that you've organized in Pamplona? And the running of the bulls there, of course, is what running bulls traditionally on the way to the arena for the bullfight. What's the running of the nudes?
Of course. Well, the running of the nudes is a compassionate alternative to the running of the bulls. Many people who attend the running of the bulls, which is a part of the Festival of San Fermín, which is a 9-day festival in which 8 days of running of bulls. What a lot of people don't realize is that when you actually go to the running of the bulls, you're supporting bullfighting, because those very bulls that are run at 8 o'clock in the morning will be tortured and killed in the evening in the bull ring. So, again, trying to bring attention to the plight of these animals, these bulls who feel as much pain as you and I, have the same capacity to feel to suffer as a dog or a cat would, these animals that are tortured, we wanted to bring attention to bullfighting. And so we decided that we were going to do a demonstration that people could attend. People could go to Pamplona and do something as crazy as the running of the bulls, as exciting, as different as the running of the bulls, but we're no animal would suffer.
And what do you say to the claims of artistry, that there's a deep kind of drama being acted out here with a long tradition that achieves artistry? What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly artistry in the sense, but I mean, it's a barbaric ritual that I don't think anybody can be able to argue. I mean, just as someone could try to defend bullfighting, someone could also try to defend cockfighting, or where two men killed each other in, you know, ancient Greek times. Bottom line is, in the year 2005, whether you're in Spain or whether you're in the United States or any other country, the killing of animals should not be celebrated.
William Rivas-Rivas, we thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much.
William Rivas-Rivas, spokesperson for PETA. He created the Running of the Nudes in Pamplona. We'll hear a response from Edward Lewine and from his new book, Death in the Sun, in just a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Edward Lewine. His new book is Death in the Sun, A Matador's Season in the Heart of Spain. It's a book about bullfighting, the art, the spectacle, what Ernest Hemingway called the tragedy of bullfighting. What do you see? Do you see the artistry? Will this someday be history? Or is this blood sport here to stay? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We know a lot of you are waiting with calls. We'll turn to you just shortly, but I want to get Edward Lewine's response to William Rivas-Rivas. Straight-up condemnation, saying this is torture, this is wrong, it just shouldn't be. What do you say? I'm sure it's not the first time you've heard this.
Well, you know, Mr. Rivas is an advocate for a point of view. He's an animal rights advocate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a journalist, as I say right up front in my book is not designed to convince anyone that bullfighting is a great thing. And perfectly content, in fact, I have no interest in whether anyone likes bullfighting or dislikes it. What I wanted to do is understand it. And trying to understand other cultures, I think, is also a moral thing. And so if someone thinks that bullfighting is horrible because it is an event in which animals are killed for entertainment, I can't argue with that point. I don't argue with it.
But you do go farther than strict journalism. You say, for my part, I've decided that the cruelty in bullfighting is balanced by its beauty.
Yes.
And
but that's what—that's a decision that each person has to make. As we make the decision to eat meat, we make the decision to wear leather, or we don't do those things. We make the decision to hunt, or we don't do those things. Each person has to decide what their relationship to animals is, and it's a difficult decision. And people go through a lot of intelligent people go through many different ups and downs with it. And I would not attempt to influence anyone's decision on that point of view. And if anyone thinks bullfighting is horrible, all I can say is that's a reasonable point of view.
Mm-hmm. You take the nuance there on board in the front of the book. You're quoting here François Rochefoucauld saying, neither the sun nor death can be looked at steadily. You see a morality play, a kind of lesson on human mortality in addition to the bull's mortality in the bull ring. What is that lesson, that learning you take?
Well, there's so many things which bullfighting teaches you. It teaches you to look at your own culture in a different way, but it teaches you to look at death, if you look at it honestly, and to see the generations pass and the fact that every living creature dies. This is a part of everything that goes on in this planet. It's inescapable, and it gives you it gives me some solace that although these beautiful animals die, each year more are bred. I will say one thing about what Mr. Rivas said that I would like to point out.
Mm.
The bulls do suffer in the ring. They are tortured. If bullfighting ceased to exist, those bulls would cease to exist because they are raised in a very expensive fashion purely for this art form or for this cruel spectacle.
And as you described, they're raised in lines that are known for their tendency to fight, to be ferocious in the circumstance.
They are a particular species of animal, and while that animal would stop suffering if bullfights ended, the animal would also cease to exist.
Let's begin to take our callers. Kathleen is calling from Cambridge Springs, Pennsylvania. Hi, Kathleen. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. I traveled to Spain in the late 90s and as a tourist and, of course, wanted to attend a bullfight. So I went to La Ronda, which is in the south, and it's the smallest bull ring, I think, in the world, at least in Spain. So I was literally right on top of things. It was a very, very small venue. I can't remember the exact dimensions, but there weren't that many seats, so you weren't, like, very far away.
And did you see artistry or butchery? How did it look to you, Kathleen?
I found it very interesting. I don't have any strong views one way or another about animal rights, so I didn't go in with a certain attitude toward it. I actually found it quite beautiful. They handled it very well. It seemed to be sort of a social event for the community. People, you know, brought their picnic lunches, and so it reminded me a bit of Picnic on the Battlefield or something. They even kind of joke with people who they know have no experience, so they obviously knew that I wasn't a regular or even from their country, and so, you know, they were trying to get the ear for me, and I said thanks, but no thanks kind of thing. But I found it not repulsive in any way. It was handled very artistically, and I was very close to it. So,
Kathleen, you're broad-minded, and we hear you watching it from right on top of it there. Edward, I wish you'd read a little bit more for us, because it's something that speaks to what the Spanish make of this. On page 32, you write about this notion of summoning up the demon in the bullfight, the duende. Could you read a bit of that passage for us?
Aficionados say there's a special feeling that comes when a great matador passes a bull low and slow around his body, and the bull responds, charging hard at the cape and lending solemnity and danger to the matador's movements. Hemingway described it as a lump in the throat. Federico Garcia Lorca, the poet, called it man's finest anger, his finest melancholy, and his finest grief. It is an electric mixture of fear, pleasure and beauty, sadness, anger, horror, joy, tension, the feeling of victory over death, and the viewer's relief that he or she is safe and not facing the bull. According to Garcia Lorca, this dark yet sweet emotion can be inspired by any art form, but especially by the two Spanish arts of bullfighting and flamenco music. When a torero or a flamenco artist loses himself and begins creating on the very edge of reason and capacity, he may, Garcia Lorca said, summon up a demon called the duende, who can make the powerful emotion run. This duende is not brought into being necessarily by talent or skill, but rather by the artist's ability to give himself over to the moment and by his ties of blood and history to the essential culture of Spain, which for Garcia Lorca is found always in the bullfight.
Edward Lewine reading from his book Death and the Sun. Paul is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Paul. You're on the air. What do you think?
I'm really enjoying your discussion. I've been to Spain 3 times. My girlfriend, actually, her second last name is Toro, so I guess I have some sympathy for the bullfighter. But I just had a couple of comments. She tells me that they like to say torero rather than matador, because matador means killer or murderer. And I also wanted to address the PETA comments. I don't feel like they have a legitimate criticism here, because they oppose killing of animals under any circumstance. So they couldn't obviously recognize or acknowledge any artistry or what have you, because they would not condone it under any circumstance.
Yeah, it doesn't make their view irrelevant, but I take your point.
And the other question I had was, is it true that the bulls, I'm going to go see my first bullfight hopefully this fall when I'm visiting in October, is it true that the bulls don't see a man on foot until they enter the ring? And my last question is, how are the bulls used after they're killed?
Good questions, Paul. Thank you. Edward?
They do use the word matador. Torero is a general word for all kind of bullfighters, and matador is the leader of the bull, the bullfighting team, and there's no negative connotation to the word matador. Bulls are raised on very large ranches, and they have never experienced the conditions of a bullfight before, because bulls are very intelligent. And if you pass a bull with a cape and you stand in front of it, the bull starts to learn. And after a period of time, a bull that's been handled in that way will get the trick and start going for the man and not the cape. So it's true, they're kept away from generally people on feet, although it's a little dramatic to say they never see one, but they basically never see one.
And after the bullfight, as I read you, the bull goes straight to the slaughterhouse.
There are slaughterhouses in every bull ring. and the bulls are reduced to meat, to cuts of meat in about 5 minutes, put into a refrigerated truck, and sold the next day at your local butcher.
Like any other beef would be in Spain?
Like any other beef.
Megan is calling from Scituate, Massachusetts. Megan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Very interesting conversation. I lived in Spain for several years. It's very dear to my heart. I met my husband there and was married there and lived there with him, although we're both Americans.
Yes.
And fell in love with Spanish culture and completely understand the author's feelings about it. We lived in the south in the country, and so I got to experience running of the bulls in the small country towns.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot different than what you see on ESPN. It's when they take a small town, they block off all the streets, and everybody gets really drunk, and they chase this animal around until it's exhausted and sliding on the cobblestones. And it was just a horrible, horrible experience to watch. And I was so excited to go because I thought it was going to be amazing. But
Now, this was not in the ring, but it was the running of the bull as if on the way, and it just looked like what? Just the torture word comes back in your description.
Well, yeah, it was like, you know, a main street in a very old, hundreds of years old city that was all cobblestoned, lots of drunk kids, very machismo, chasing this bull who was, you know, panting and sliding on the cobblestones and running from these people, or sometimes running at it, but they got it so exhausted, and they were all screaming and drunk. And
it doesn't sound like art. Megan, our time is short, but thank you for that picture. Edward Levine, what do you say to that? Is it different from what goes on in the ring? Is it of a piece?
Well, the bull culture of Spain is very complicated, and what I give you in my book is the very upper levels of it, formal, professional bullfighting. What the caller is describing is a thing which does happen, and it happens in a lot of little villages and towns around Spain, and it is pretty awful. It's pretty much kind of all the awful aspects of formal bullfighting without really any of the redeeming qualities, and it's very hard, I think, for an outsider to understand how anyone could participate in something like that. But all I can tell you is cultures are different. They view animals differently, and many of the people I'm sure who participate in that event are people who otherwise generally one would think were very nice people, but they have a different worldview than we do. And the hard thing always is to try to understand.
Our time is almost gone, and we've scarcely touched on your matador himself, Francisco Rivera Ordóñez. I was struck to see he spent time in summer camps in Maine and was sent to military school in Indiana, then came back to be one of the most celebrated matadors in Spain. He's still a relatively young man. What's the life expectancy for matadors? Do most get wounded? Do many die?
Most matadors expect to spend about 3 to 6 weeks in the hospital every year. But as one famous matador said, I stand still and the bull does all the work. So matadors go on and on and on if they want to. There was one who retired at the age of 68 recently. But most of them tire of the life. Honestly, the fear mounts up in you over time. And another thing we didn't talk about is that the schedule is brutal and they drive all night from bullfight to bullfight. And eventually, really what gets most of them is the travel, to be perfectly honest.
Talked about sort of almost a bullfight every day, maybe six bullfights in a week.
In August and September, as Fran's grandfather once said, someone asked his grandfather, Maestro, what does it take to be a great matador? And he said, the ability to sleep in cars. And that's absolutely true. It's just brutal, the travel.
Well, Edward Levine, I can tell people are going to have many different views, even on learning a bit more about bullfighting. But we thank you for taking us into it and sharing your insights with us. Thanks for being with us tonight.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Edward Levine, author of Death and the Sun, A Matador's Season in the Heart of Spain, close with Hemingway here. The bullfight is not a sport in the Anglo-Saxon sense of the word. That is, it is not an equal contest or an attempt at an equal contest between a bull and a man. Rather, it is a tragedy. In a moment, fact overwhelms fiction for London-based author Chris Cleave. This is On Point.
No había en el mundo pa' mi otra mujer. Anhelo los besos de su labio rojo. Vivía fue yo el de mi querer.
July 7th was supposed to be a big day for British writer Chris Cleave. His first novel, Incendiary, which centers on a fictional terrorist attack at a British soccer game, was slated to be published that day. Promotional posters were hung in the London Underground, depicting the city's skyline billowing smoke and tagged with the words, What If? And then, to Chris Cleve's shock and the world's, the unthinkable happened. On that very same day, a real terrorist attack on London, 3 subway trains and a bus killed more than 50, and gave Cleve's novel a terrible new relevance. Tonight, Chris Cleve reads a passage from his new book and recalls the emotion he felt when he learned about the July 7th bombings.
The first thing I heard about the attack was when I turned on my TV at 9:30 in the morning and realised that what I had been thinking about in my novel for more than a year now was actually happening. The first thing that went through my mind was a sensation of unbelievable shock. I didn't know if I was losing my mind, the coincidence that this was happening on the day that my novel was published. It just seemed too extraordinary. And immediately after that wave of shock just came this sensation of absolute sadness, because we very quickly realised that a very terrible thing had happened and a lot of people were affected. When we realised that what had happened was really serious, the first reaction for myself and also for my publishers, we were just doing what everyone in London was doing, which was to ring around and check, find out if people we knew were safe. And mercifully, we were all okay. And then we had a phone call and said, right, we've just got to do the right thing here. What is that? We decided immediately that we would take down all of the advertising. There were some posters in the tube and there was some print advertising that had been bought. And we decided that immediately, out of respect for the people who'd been affected, we should remove that advertising. But we had a good think about the book, and we decided that since it's not a glorification of terrorism, and it's not a sensationalist book, actually it's an examination of how one woman and a society recovers after a terrorist attack, we decided that we were still very proud of the book and we would let it remain on sale. My book is written as an open letter to Osama bin Laden in the voice of a woman who's lost her son and her husband at a terrorist attack at a soccer match in London. It's a plea for the end to all violence. She believes that if she can make Osama understand for just one second the force of love that there is in the world, especially the love that she had for her son, then there's no way he would be able to continue to prosecute his campaign of terror. I'm going to read the first couple of pages from Incendiary, which I hope will give you an idea of where the narrator is coming from and how she starts to unfold her letter to Osama bin Laden. Dear Osama, they want you dead or alive so the terror will stop. Well, I wouldn't know about that. I mean, rock and roll didn't stop when Elvis died on the Kazi. It just got worse. Next thing you know, there was Sonny and Cher and Dexy's Midnight Runners. I'll come to them later. My point is, it's easier to start these things than to finish them. I suppose you thought of that, did you? There's a reward of $25 million on your head, but don't lose sleep on my account, Osama. I have no information leading to your arrest or capture. I have no information, full effing stop. I'm what you'd call an infidel and my husband called working class. There is a difference, you know. But just supposing I did clap eyes on you. Supposing I saw you driving a Nissan Primera down towards Shoreditch and grassed you to the old bill. Well, I wouldn't know how to spend $25 million. It's not as if I've got anyone to spend it on since you blew up my husband and my boy. That's my whole point, you see. I don't want $25 million, Osama. I just want you to give it a rest. Am I alone? I want to be the last mother in the world who ever has to write you a letter like this. Who ever has to write to you, Osama, about her dead boy.
Chris Cleve, reading from his new novel, Incendiary. The novel will be released in the United States next month. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.